It's the Religious Studies Project again.
Did you miss us?
This is officially week 74, but we think it's like 85 or something recent, really. Welcome back. We're glad to have you. This is going to be a good one for me. I'm excited. It combines two of the things I like the most. Religion and comic books.
Oh, David, because that is your name, David.
It is, yeah.
I just won't even attempt to say anything here, because I own a graphic novel, but no, let's call it a comic book. It's Firefly, Joss Whedon's Firefly. It's sort of an extra episode of Firefly that was done.
Joss Whedon is a respected comic writer. He had a very successful run on X-Men, I believe, yeah. Following on from Grant Morrison.
And of course, anyway, and season 8 of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
I don't think he wrote any of that. He was kind of overseeing it. But he has actually written comic book. So, as my associate Christopher Cotter mentioned, I am David. I'm a David, but I'm not a David Lewis. But this is
fantastic. Enjoy it, folks.
I'm here today with Aaron David Lewis, who is a recent graduate, got his PhD at the Boston University Division of Religious and Theological Studies, where I am also doing my dissertation and my PhD studies, so David and I know each other rather well, or A. Dave, as he likes to be called.
Please.
And he did his own dissertation work on the superhero afterlife.
That's right.
Work that he is continuing now as well. He has also edited a collection of essays with Christine Hoff Kramer, another Terrier BU alum, who titled Graven Images, Religion in Comic Books and Graphic Novels, and is co-editing a new collection of essays on digital death.
That's right.
Coming out in 2014?
2014, co-editing it with Christopher Mormon, and it's sort of spinning out of a series of presentations and discussions. We're both members of the steering committee for the Death, Dying, and Beyond group at the American Academy of Religion. And we've had a multitude of papers and interests in the topic of how mortality works. So it's going to cover the gamut of that topic that there's considerable interest in.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating. I can't wait for that. And as you might have caught on, we're here to talk about comic books.
Yeah.
And religion.
What could be better?
What could be better? Exactly. So, my first question is very broad. What does the scholarly study of religion and comic books look like?
It is still, like your question, quite broad. That is to say that it's been only starting to gel over the last several years. That's not to say that there weren't people looking at it and working on it in previous years, but I'll quote my co-editor, Christine Kramer, who said that we really did the original Graven Images Conference, and that's 2008 before it became a book, at close to its tipping point. We really found the right moment. We were fortunate enough to find the right moment to turn this into something slightly more formal. There are no degrees in religion, in comics. In fact, it is very hard, despite the fact that comics are pervading all different disciplines throughout universities in both the U.S., especially abroad, but I'm focusing here on the U.S. market, it's difficult to find a comic studies degree at all. So you have any number of disciplines and fields beginning to look at how they interface with this medium, with the medium as a medium, the content of the medium, the way the medium is used, the way it's distributed, consumed, etc. I'll rewind a little bit to say that we still have decades of history between religion and comics. While it is a newer, legitimately recognized study, the data goes back decades, if not over a century.
Yeah.
we can go back to woodcutting, woodcut novels. We can go back to illuminated manuscripts and Bibles and such. And some might argue, and this is where it starts to get a bit more tenuous, that ancient hieroglyphics could be seen as what Scott McCloud, a comics theorist, would suggest is proto-comics. So if we want to look at it through one lens, this is an ancient engagement. The active discussion, analysis, serious study on it is a much more recent phenomenon.
But it ties into these older traditions of visual depictions of religious messages and stories.
And the prohibition, and prohibitions against the same thing. What power images or images used in a particular context, images used in sequence with each other, what power they have, both sacred and taboo. And the content doesn't have to be limited to the sacred, I should mention. We have any number of stories that involve religious elements, whether they're real life, autobiographical, or entirely fantastic and supernatural. But another way to look at comics and religion is to look at how comics are used as religion. Fan communities, ritualistic pilgrimages, what is canon for a group, what is not canon for a group. And I'm sort of betraying my own biases here. Before religious studies, I was quite involved with literary theory. In fact, it was literary theory that brought me to religious studies. So when I start thinking about canonicity, and I start thinking about how stories form, the narratology of stories, whether they're sacred lore or myth or so forth, I see it as a zone of total engagement. I don't separate the two quite so much. But yeah, it can be religious content. It can be the way the comics are used in a religion-like manner. In a, I think it was Adam Possume who called it hyper-religion. Things that are acting as religions that may or may not be. And then we can also look at the engagement of religions, modern world religions, using comics as a platform. And while they're not as, let's say, in the public eye as Superman on one hand, you got your superhero comics, or of your more grim and gritty comics like Walking Dead, that's now a television series. Two Guns is now in theaters. That was a graphic novel beforehand. Well, the religious comics being used by religious groups is not as in the public eye. It's still becoming more and more common that this is a useful communication medium for them.
What would be a good example of a that type of comic?
Well, the most renowned example would be what they call Chick Tracks. Jack Chick was the original illustrator, writer, and they're basically these small rectangular comics, you know, not much bigger than two credit cards next to each other. But they would proselytize. They would be printed in the hundreds of thousands. He is said to be the most successful self-published comics creator ever. These Chick Tracks would go out not only across the United States, but across the world, talking about why Christianity is right and why these other practices or behaviors are wrong. They're rather inflammatory, to be honest. I mean, they're not, they don't pull any punches whatsoever. These are not ecumenical in the least. A slightly more kind kind version is that I believe the New York Archdiocese produced a comic to combat or raise awareness about sexual abuse. So they were thinking of comics as targeting probably a younger demographic. And that's not wrong. Comics are not for kids. You'll see all these articles and all these, comics aren't for kids anymore. And certainly we're talking about it in a serious context, but I think the beauty of comics or sequential art or graphic novels is how they function at all age levels. They aid children in beginning their literacy. But I think what we've recognized in the academy and certainly in publishing over the last few decades is that they can still be rich with adult themes and text and visual interface. So New York Archdiocese produces a comic to combat, to address issues of sexual abuse around the time of these sex scandals and whether or not the Vatican knew of them. I'm not taking a position here. It came out about that time. So those would be two key examples.
What about comics that take known religious stories, narratives, and puts them into comic format? I know that those exist because I think we've spoken about them before. What relationship do they have with the religious communities that also use those stories in more traditional textual
forms? Oh, that's funny. Okay, well, for some, they're a hard sell. For some, the visualizing of these stories is difficult to digest. I have to imagine it was not dissimilar to early cinema attempting to lens these stories. There was a time when doing something like Passion of the Christ or even the Ten Commandments was looked on very askance by a religious community. That said, and here I'm specifically thinking of publishers like Kingstone Media. Kingstone Media produces rather high quality comics that are either adaptations of religious lore, specifically Christian, Judeo-Christian religious lore, or produce comics and graphic novels where the characters are very firmly rooted in their devout Christian belief. They have won people over. They've won a lot of religious communities over because these do become very popular. They're very accessible, and they give people a new view or a new life to some of these works that, while they trusted in them, while they kept them as quite sacred, while they valued them, couldn't animate them visually in their mind's eye. The question I thought you were going to ask, was how is this cottage industry viewed by the comics industry, the larger comics industry? Because I emphasized Kingstone's quality because Jack Chick's group or groups that produced work like Chick were very much were very garage band, were very rough and not. Not as finished as the books that we see on comic book shelves and now increasingly in bookstores. So the comics community, the comics industry rather, I should say, has been looking on, I think, religiously themed or religiously oriented works with greater appreciation, especially as the quality, the craftsmanship, and frankly the sales of them have increased. When I wasn't studying comics, I was also creating them, as you know. And one of my graphic novels, The Lone and Level Sands, occupies this odd space between not being for religious community, yet being a religious story. I take the book of Exodus, the story of Exodus, rather, and tell it from the perspective of the Egyptian royal family. And this came right in the wake of September 11th, and then later, right in the wake of September 11th and the ensuing wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I was always curious in this story, in this lore, in this myth, in this history, but all views on it, all perspectives on it, an anthropological view, a historical view, an archaeological view. So I've been interested in both communities. I've been interested in the religious community that's involved with comics, and I've been interested in the comics community utilizing religion. It's been a fraught yet rewarding space to occupy.
Yeah. So are these types of comics, we'll move to different ways mm-hmm. that religion mm-hmm. Finds itself in comic books, or sure. we find religion in comic books, but just sticking to this for one more minute. These types of comics that retell already known religious stories or aspects of them, do they tend to reinterpret things as well and shift the lens a little bit like you did, or are they more, are some comic book creators more apt to really want to do a faithful, whatever that means,
you right.
know, faithful, literal, sort of visual rendering of the story as they know it?
I think the difficulty that these works met with, certainly 70s, 80s, even to a degree of the 90s,
yeah.
was that any visualization requires interpretation.
Yeah.
I mean, we can drill down on that further. Any mm-hmm. reading requires interpretation. But you have a huge additional layer. So you do get comics creators that are very concerned with being faithful to the accepted or dogmatic reading of a particular text. This isn't limited to Judeo-Christian mm-hmm. Either. There are some that have tried to tastefully visualize without literally visualizing the life of Muhammad
yeah.
for the Quran. I've seen comics.
Does the figure actually appear in these comics or not? I have to ask.
In the ones that I'm thinking of, no.
Okay.
He does not. I have seen some not intended for a Muslim community, not made by Muslim creators
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Who have depicted Muhammad in the flesh. But I'm also thinking of comics about the Buddhist bardos
mm-hmm,
of the afterlife,
mm-hmm.
the stories of the Hindu deities. There's a
mm-hmm.
great series called India Authentic that's out there. And in India itself, these religiously themed comics are huge. I'm going to butcher the term, but I think they're Amar Kita Chita.
Yeah.
Edit that if I got that
yeah,
term wrong,
yeah.
but they're huge in other communities, global communities. So the first half of your question is yes, you will have very cautious
uh-huh.
interpretations. Other creators set out either to put the story ahead of the community's view of things, or, and this I think is much more unsettling, they are totally dedicated to the original text, but not the community. The one that I'm thinking of here is R. Crumb, who was famous throughout the 70s for doing rather racy, counterculture, underground comics, recently put out his own illustrated book of Genesis. And what he did, rather than straying from the text, he was quite literal in ways that I think would challenge certain concepts of having read Genesis. One example that comes to mind is he initially illustrates the serpent in the Garden of Eden having nothing to do with Satan, so that's a very New Testament later approach, but also having arms and legs, so that the curse put on the serpent for having intruded with Adam
yeah.
and Eve, is a true curse. You must slither now. He shows all the wives of, let's say, Jacob, including his slave wives. He shows the actual discord and withered womb between Hagar and Sarai, or Sarah, from Genesis. So I guess I'm bringing this all back towards saying you can be quite visually faithful
mm-hmm.
to a sacred text in a way that still could trouble a faith community. And you can be visually, I don't want to say unfaithful, but visually liberal, visually wild, visually
yeah.
All over in a way that's quite comforting to a faith community. But this, of course, predates comics even. I'm thinking about many portrayals of Jesus, many portrayals
of course,
right. of Moses. I'm thinking of Dory's illustrations of From Paradise Lost in Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
So you will get all varieties. It will impact bottom line sales and reception, of course.
Yeah. Is the medium read or looked at widely enough to be have any works that are affecting the way that people are depicting these stories? Or do you think that it's...
Yes, but I think it's on a religion-by-religion basis.
Okay.
For instance, I think that the pagan or neo-pagan community has been hugely receptive, despite all its variety. I'm not trying to pigeonhole pagans as all one group, but has been hugely responsive to some of the mainstream work put out there by Alan Moore and Grant Morrison, who have really been able to take their ideas of what these different faiths are doing or depicting and make them into comics. I do think that... I think some comics that have addressed religion have been more successful outside the religion they're portraying. What comes to mind here is Habibi by Craig Thompson recently came out, and I think it was less impactful for American Muslims than it was for non-Muslims trying to get some view, some purchase on Islam that they might not already have. At the same time, one of the first graphic novels not only to be recognized as a graphic novel, but to be carried in bookstores nationwide back in the 80s, this is Art Spiegelman's Mouse, was actually quite important for a number of Jewish communities. Mm-hmm. This way of not only depicting the Holocaust, but depicting the aftermath of the Holocaust, the generations that followed. The Holocaust, circa World War II, I think have been important for that community. So this isn't just, this isn't happening in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is getting real responses. I don't think it's changing or affecting any theologies, but it may be giving new outlets to practice, mm-hmm. or at least new outlets to representation, new access to preconceptions that either external groups have or a group in question may want to share.
Yeah. This may not be something that you have thought about, done work on, or research, but it just occurred to
me. Hey, I'll spitball. It just
occurred to me. Have you noticed or come across any reaction from religious communities that you touched upon this sort of issue in the history of visual depictions of religion, that often they are also banned or forbidden, mm-hmm. or you know, is there any sense that some religious communities think that, that mediums like comic book, let's say, it doesn't have to be comic book or graphic novels, cheapen or desacralize or even secularize the stories? Is that something
I'm nodding my head vigorously as he asks this question. Yes, that has certainly been the case. In fact, I think that was the assumption up until maybe late 70s, early 80s here in the United States. The idea that comics is juvenile medium, unless this is intended for kids, intended to simplify, not only are you being... fast and loose with the source material that is sacred, but you are actually being rather transgressive in portraying it. That was the assumption up until recent times. And even still, we have any number of groups that, first of all, will see comic books and graphic novels, will lump it in under decadent, maybe even Western or luxury secular depictions. And there's any number of things to challenge that, but it's difficult to challenge perception.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll get, if they don't already hold that opinion of it, they'll look at the particular work and find the particular work distasteful for the way it involves some very dearly held concepts. unrest over this has happened much more pronouncedly in Europe and overseas than it has here, mm-hmm. particularly in the form of cartooning.
Right, now,
the fields are separate, editorial cartoonists. Here we might have Garfield or Family Circus mm-hmm. and so forth, and comic books, but they do share the way that television and cinema share a similar toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been violent protests, and there's been tragedy surrounding the way religion has been depicted in cartoons and cartooning and editorials. And I think that has more to do with their slightly less narrative. They have slightly less opportunity to be narrative. And they are more often in a public space. That, you know, if you're not going to trip over a story of Superman accidentally, but you might on one page of a magazine or a newspaper or even graffitied onto a wall encounter a depiction of the Pope in an unflattering way, of mm-hmm. Muhammad in an unflattering way, anti-Semitic.
All over the internet now, too.
Oh, and people the internet,
will share
that's
these
right.
Images on Facebook and,
One thing that's curious, and maybe this is too much of a tangent, is that in the late 90s, early turn of the 21st century, scholarship was very quick to jump on the internet and create a field for it. And some people have even argued that the hypertext studies or digital domain studies may have actually stunted its growth somewhat. That's why we're here with YouTube. Rather than seeing more films generated, what we'd call full-length feature films generated for the internet. Comics, for better or for worse, has remained a comfortably fringe medium. We keep applying serious study to it, but no one's frozen it with study. So, while these same groups may look at, the ones I was talking about earlier, may look at the internet askance, may look at magazines, periodicals, comic books, film, television, music, fashion, all askance in terms of whether they can actually convey and contain genuine religious content, comics still remains kind of nicely quicksilver. It continues to have the underdog status, at least right now. Half of me hopes for the day where we already have organizations and institutions, but hopes for the day that there's a department of comic studies, and part of me doesn't, because at that point there will be sort of a fixity to it.
Okay. So let's shift a little bit to your own work, for instance, the work on Superhero Afterlife.
Oh, yeah.
Here we're not dealing with explicitly religious stories. But we're dealing with religion intersecting with comic books. Can you sort of get us there?
Sure. I am dealing with a particular genre of comics, the superhero comic. It's a large genre, but I don't want to mistake comics and superheroes as being synonymous. The strange thing about the superhero genre, and this was identified a long time ago by none less than Umberto Eco, was that the way we treat superheroes in America is they really can't age. They can't change radically. There has to only be the illusion of change. At some point, a reset button has to be pushed. Superman has to be perpetually fresh. Spider-Man can't be too much more than a teenager. The comics industry, the modern comics industry, being about 80 years old, we do not have an 80-year-old Batman. We don't have an 80-year-old Wonder Woman.
But why not?
Well, because of the serial nature of comics. Both serial in that you wait till the next issue, next month, the continuing adventures, or just going from panel to panel, going from picture to picture, there's this idea built into its DNA that this is always continuing. There's never a full stop. Unlike a prose novel, and hold on, I know there are many prose novels that have been serialized. There are many prose novels that have gotten sequels
right.
and continuing adventures, but that's not built into its DNA. The novel is based on the sentence that ends in a period.
Mm-hmm.
Comics are not. So we need superheroes to stay perpetually fresh, and this gives them a very odd relationship to mortality and finality. It's even given them the kind of mythic status mm-hmm. that would be accorded Odysseus, that would be accorded Aeneas, to some degree, Dante and so forth,
yeah.
that their creators over the years have them take any number of trips into an afterlife. Because if these characters are always remaining fresh,
yeah.
even taking them into the afterlife doesn't finish them off. One of the definitional elements of the superhero, I argue, is that you're only a superhero when you come back from the dead. And that sounds very Christological,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure. And any number of Christian readers or people looking at it with a Christian lens will see Superman particularly that way. The last son sent to the planet to save it. And there was a death and return of Superman during the 1990s. But there's been a critical mass, as far as I was concerned, of superheroes traveling into the afterlife and
yeah.
coming back, that it was becoming its own distinct subgenre. There were things that superheroes had to do in the afterlife that I found so peculiar. Because no one was dictating this, right? No one was saying, oh, Fred, you're writing a story about a superhero going to the afterlife? Make sure they do the following things. Bop, 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 bop. And yet, reading it enough times, I was finding that all these different writers, all these different creators, different companies, different properties, were having superheroes do the same sort of things each time in the afterlife. Six distinct elements, actually. And let's see if I can do this. It's like the Seven Dwarves. I forget them each time. This is part of my upcoming work on superhero afterlife, copyright, trademark, etc. Most superheroes that go to the afterlife, whether this is heaven, hell, the garden, the fire, Sheol, Valhalla, hell, the Egyptian afterlife, you name it, almost every time they'll first have to access it by means of an alternate dimension. No one slips into the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be a journey. They will encounter a family member. They will go through some sort of dream or hallucination or delusion. They will encounter an opponent. I call it an Alastor, basically something that represents an opponent, even in heaven,
mm-hmm.
even in a paradisal experience. They'll have a heroic reversal. Some character will act out of character. Either a villain will act like a hero, a hero will act like a villain. And then finally, they liberate people. Almost every time someone gets out of the afterlife, this permanent and final destination for many religions,
mm-hmm.
not all, of course, these six elements recur with such frequency that I had to start looking at them. I think there's something that serious that's being said there by this compulsion to write these heroes in a certain way.
So there's a sense in which, as you introduced it, there's a sort of similarity between the comic book medium and storytelling in the comic book medium and myth and folklore.
Yes.
Right? I was thinking when you were describing comic books as sort of indefinite
mm-hmm.
narrative, you know, the sort of, I always imagine, I didn't read that many comic books, but I have this impression in my head that they always end in an ellipsis.
Yeah,
know? Like
very much
they
so.
They always end in a dot, dot, dot. But
and even when they don't, the reader still reads an ellipsis there. I got to tell you that
right.
comics readers, after enough time, even if a writer is trying to give a sense of closure, a sense of an ending, I'm thinking of Frank Kermode's book here, A Sense of an Ending,
mm-hmm.
That all of fiction, all novels are based on apocalypse, are based on the idea that everything ends.
Right.
That these narratives in comics, these superhero narratives, are actually working against that. I don't want to say they're anti-Christian. I'm not saying that.
Right.
I'm not saying they're anti-revelatory. They're anti-apocalyptic. but they are satisfying something totally different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking about how folklore, especially and particularly mm-hmm. as oral tradition, mm-hmm. Isn't fixed the way that a lot of Western textual traditions have been fixed mm-hmm. once things were starting to be published and really written down. And it seems like there's a similarity there. You know, there's an indefinite quality about these folktales because they can, you know, think about the sort of so-called gods of Hinduism or mm-hmm. these mythical characters. There are an indefinite number of feats, an indefinite number of stories that have, you know, some of them are canonical, some of them you've never heard and you never will hear because they were in this particular region, in this particular village, you know. And there's a sort of, it seems like there's a similarity here to...
There's a great similarity there, and the similarity continues as you consider the comic book industry. Going with your example of the Hindu gods and how the various pantheons of Hinduism, whether it's monotheistic for a particular locality, but then polytheistic across a continent, I look at it similar to the way that different comic book imprints are bought and sold, absorbed, different mergers happen, different characters mm-hmm. become part of another larger character's story. For instance, the DC universe that we have today, think Super Friends, if you will, mm-hmm. think Batman and Superman and so forth. DC Comics, now a subsidiary of Time Warner, has bought any number of comics properties along the way, has absorbed mm-hmm. them. So not just narratively, I know you were thinking of narratively, yeah. and I agree
right.
narratively,
right.
but I'm also thinking socially
mm-hmm.
and industrially. The same sort of blending has happened particular to this medium and genre. I don't think we see a TV show like Cheers getting absorbed into X-Files, which later gets absorbed into Scrubs, which later gets absorbed into The Real Housewives of Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that I think is rather peculiar, special, to comic books. I also want to add, though, that when you said that this sounds mythic,
mm-hmm.
much of my research is based on, or initially was based on myth studies, things like Vladimir Propp, identifying that certain folklores had these following mm-hmm. elements, X number of things you can expect, and studies of the Brothers Grimm's tales. So, what I'm suggesting is not wildly out of left field. I'm just trying to draw it closer to the genre work of people like Paul Ricoeur,
mm-hmm.
who saw genre in terms of building faith communities, shared stories or shared elements of mm-hmm. stories, whether or not they're fixed is a
right.
separate question, about building a sense of community and identity. Part of my argument in my writing is that the superhero afterlife specifically, not just superheroes, but the superhero afterlife is building a community and is building a sense of specific selfhood. That's hard to say. A sense of specific selfhood for its growing readership.
That's really interesting. Another thing that I'm not sure if you mentioned here or if I gleaned this when I was reading the introduction to Graven Images, but is the idea that sometimes whole religions are invented within
yeah.
the comic book universe.
Yeah.
Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Most often you'll have invented religions for two reasons, either to operate as straw men or to operate as placeholders. I'm reminded of The Avengers is popular now. The Avengers is a movie. Mm-hmm. Well, this was an Avengers storyline where they weren't sure if they should accept a new member. The member's name was Triathlon, and he was a good guy, great superpowers, but he was part of the Triune understanding that in his non-superheroing time, he would be part of what the other heroes considered a cult. Now, we, as literary and religious scholars, know that cult is not actually a bad word, but these mutants and robots and super soldiers and science armor wearers were looking at this guy askance because he was basically the stand-in at that moment for Scientology. They didn't want to name Scientology, but they still wanted to address how do you deal with someone who seems to have the same morals as you, who seems to be a do-gooder, and yet doesn't fit your system. Another from the Marvel Universe that comes to mind, and this was called the Universal Church of Truth. And this was created by a writer named Jim Starlin. He did all these great cosmic stories, and he had this great cosmic character named Adam Warlock, who at some point in the future, it was predicted, would turn evil. So he's a great space savior at the moment, but at some point in the future, he would go evil. He'd be called the Magus, and this would kick off the Universal Church of Truth, which in turn would travel back in time and fight Adam Warlock. So we have some sci-fi nonsense going on here, but this was Starlin's cover for how he felt about Christianity. Mm-hmm. He felt that while Jesus was great and powerful and should be revered, that how the church later regarded Jesus corrupted the original. And that the original Jesus, his Adam Warlock, which is has a whole history to the name, would be opposed to the church that reveres him, even if there is a manifestation of him later that is corrupted and that is leading it.
Yeah.
So there are alien religions created all the time. And one more element I'd add to this is that more often than not, most mainstream large publisher superhero companies will be more inclined to address and involve a stand-in religion rather than possibly alienate or criticize or demonize a real world religion.
That's really interesting. So we've been talking for a while, and I think when you speak about stories, it happens this way, which I think is wonderful. But we do need to wrap up. So I have one sort of last area.
You mean this isn't to be continued? Ellipses for all
we
time?
We can leave podcast ellipses at the end. Okay. I wonder how to. I'm going to have to vocalize the ellipses in some way. What I wonder is. So you brought up a lot of really interesting themes within comic books and ways it engages, the comics directly engage religion and religious communities engage comics. Is there something about the study of comics going on right now by people looking at these religious themes and this interaction with religion that has a contribution to religious studies in general? Is there a reason why some people within religious studies, maybe not everybody, maybe not the theologians, or, you know, I don't know which little arm we can exclude, but is there something that a lot of people might need to or want to learn just as religious studies scholars from this subfield? Is there a...
I'd say yes, and then follow that up with an even louder and more emphatic yes!
Yeah.
So, of course, as we've alluded to in talking here, comics can reframe, re-envision, and challenge the visualization of any number of traditions and tradition stories. However, the larger sort of meta concept that I think comics have for religion specifically is that people think reading comics is simple. And I suppose, no offense to Jim Davis, if you read only Garfield, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Or if you read only, quote-unquote, comics for kids, well, all right. But the actual integration of word and image to form a long-form narrative is rather sophisticated. The brain chemistry involved. We have actual neuroscientists and neuropsychologists studying how people actually process comics, and it's hitting multiple hemispheres of the brains, all different, jumping all across the left and right hemisphere in different language and visual processing centers. It sounds like I'm making an argument for psychology,
yeah,
or science in the interest of comics, but I want to suggest that comics can offer a glimpse of something transcendent that some religious communities are trying to communicate. That in reading a comics page, you are looking at both the eternal, the outside of time, frozen moment of slivers of time, mm-hmm, and then you can engage it at your own speed or discretion into the chronological, into the temporal. Movies don't let us do this. They have to create the illusion of that. Movies move at their own pace and mm-hmm have come up with any number of devices to trick the viewer into thinking they have some sort of active role. I'm not disparaging movies, I'm just suggesting where they differ from comics. Prose novels and writing, nonfiction and fiction, historical, biographical, also have their own benefits, but they don't swamp the entirety of the brain in the process of communicating a multi-layered message. Comics, I argue, do. And comics, I argue, can offer a secular experience that can lead to a religious understanding, or vice versa. So this is not just for the secular community, but if the secular community wants to better understand or envision transcendent internal eternal experience, or if the religious community wants to better communicate that same concept, comics as a medium is the fertile ground for just such an engagement.
All right, great. I wish we could sit here and just indefinitely talk.
I can, but I don't think we have enough space on the disc for that.
Exactly. So, well, thank you, Dave.
It's
been a pleasure. And I hope we'll be hearing you speak about comics soon.
Viva la Comics Studies Podcast. Viva!
First myth, speaking to A. David Lewis there on religion in comic books, religion and comic books.
We probably should have said that before the interview started.
I realised, but it ruined the whole A. David thing.
Yeah, that was quite brilliant, actually. Yeah. I really enjoyed it. And we're in Doctor's Bar in Edinburgh at the moment. I'm drinking a Tynebank pint, and there's a man, a gentleman, is inconsiderately blocking David's pint.
It's a Woodford's.
There we go.
It's a Woodford's. They've made a number of excellent beers, actually. This is Sundew, one I've not had, which is a light, hoppy summer ale, which is stupid this time of year, frankly, on what is the first wintry day of the year.
Yeah, it's been quite bad. I'm going to try starting a new meme and taking photographs of the beer pumps, putting them out on our social media. And so you can comment on our beer choices as well as on our podcasts. Next week, we're running in series at the moment. That was the last one in our cultural production series. We've got another series coming up after that. But in between, we've always got a few podcasts, which, you know, sort of standalone. So next week, we have me speaking with Abby Day about belief, believing in belonging. It's her book, essentially. This idea of people who tick boxes on a census and say they're Christian, but why do they do that if they maybe don't, in other areas of their life, identify as Christian or engage in Christian practices or have particularly, quote, Christian, unquote, beliefs. And she also gives us a bit of a chat about winning research funding as well, which she's published a few books on as well. So we're looking forward to that.
Useful.
And,
Watch out for
the response to this comics podcast from Sean Jeffries on Wednesday. As we've said, Abby on Monday, and Simeon Wallace's response to that will go out the following Wednesday.
The BASR are awesome. I think they gain in awesomeness every week. By 10 weeks from now, we're probably going to be singing, like literally singing their praises. But for now,
we could.
We're both musical in that sense.
Religion and migration and diaspora coming up next. That's our next big thing. Our next series. There's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that we can't quite see yet.
We keep saying that, but there's a few projects underway, and David and I have just been talking about different directions that we could take things, because at this moment, I think it's fair for me to say on the podcast, we have enough podcasts to last us up until the end of February. We have enough interviews at the moment.
And that's more and more coming AAR.
And we're so grateful to all of our assistant editors and other contributors for getting those interviews to us. But this is now presenting us with a nice dilemma to have. It's really nice that we've now got a lot of content. So we're going to try and work out the best way to disseminate that to you without overburdening you with, because I know that a lot of people struggle even to just get the one podcast in every week. So we're thinking about different ways that we can utilize that excellent content for the best benefit of our listeners.
Yeah, you know, first world problems, as they say. Hey, you can get us on iTunes and do rate us. That would be awesome.
And we'll hit the beats of Facebook, Twitter, and Google Plus.
Google Plus, three people on Google Plus so far.
Wonderful. I think it's one's nice. Me, one's you, and one's you.
Oh, well, I started the page, so I don't know if I count. That would be four people. There's one other person that I don't know.
Wonderful.
Use our Amazon links, please do. We bored you with that last week. Yeah. We'll come back to that.
And I guess it's also okay for us to mention that we are trying to expand our scope.
Good idea.
Everything at the moment is quite sort of, understandably maybe, Anglophone focused. So we've got, you know, North America, Western Europe.
We've got some European people.
Yeah, and Australia, but particularly Asia, Africa, South America. And if you're a listener there, and you maybe want to get in touch and just, you know, let us know what's happening in the scene there. If you know of anyone, it might be someone else who could maybe contribute to the site or even be doing interviews and things for us, and we would be delighted to hear from you.
Yeah, alternatively, if you're a lecturer there and there's a student you think would be a perfect addition to the team, let us know. It doesn't have to be one person, it could be a group of people if you want to get together.
Exactly. We are aware that there's a lot of great stuff going on in the academic
and don't
study
forget
religion.
The more people that we have in the team, the less each team member has to do.
Exactly.
The same.
So, yeah. Perfect. Well, for that, let's do something that we haven't maybe done. Let's cheers. Cheers to the Religious Studies Project. And
you know what, Chris?
Thanks for listening.